Chapter 5, in which Charmaine receives her anxious parent. When Charmaine woke, she discovered that Waif had planted her vast head on the bed across Charmaine's legs. The rest of Waif was piled on the floor in a hairy white heap that filled most of the rest of the room. "So you can't go smaller on your own," Charmaine said. "I'll have to think of something." Waif's answer was a series of giant wheezings, after which she appeared to go to sleep again. Charmaine, with difficulty, dragged her legs out from under Waif's head and edged round Waif's vast body, finding clean clothes and getting into them. When she came to do her hair, Charmaine discovered that all the hairpins she usually put it up with seemed to have vanished, probably during her dive off the cliff. All she had left was a ribbon. Mother always insisted that respectable girls needed to have their hair in a neat knot on the top of their heads. Charmaine had never worn her hair any other way. "Oh, well," she said to her reflection in the neat little mirror, "Mother's not here, is she?" And she did her hair in a fat plait over one shoulder and fastened it with the ribbon. Like that, she thought her reflection looked nicer than usual, fuller in the face, and less thin and grumpy. She nodded at her reflection and picked her way around Waif to get to the bathroom. To her relief, the bathroom had thawed overnight. The room was full of soft dripping sounds from water dewing all the pipes, but nothing else seemed to be wrong, until Charmaine tried the taps. All four of them ran ice-cold water, no matter how long they ran for. "I didn't want a bath anyway," Charmaine said, as she went out into the corridor. There was no sound from Peter. Charmaine remembered Mother telling her that boys always were hard to wake in the morning. She did not let this worry her. She opened the door and turned left into the kitchen, into solid foam. Clots of foam and large single bubbles sailed past her into the corridor. "Damnation," Charmaine said. She put her head down and her arms across her head and ploughed into the room. It was as hot in there as her father's bakehouse when he was baking for a big order. "Phew," she said. "I suppose it takes days to use up a cake of soap." After that, she said nothing else because her mouth filled with soapy froth when she opened it. Bubbles worked up her nose until she sneezed, causing a small foamy whirlwind. She collided with the table and heard another teapot fall down, but she ploughed on until she ran into the laundry bags and heard the saucepans rattle on top of them. Then she knew where she was. She spared one hand from her face in order to fumble for the sink, and then along the sink until she felt the back door under her fingers. She groped for the latch. For a moment she thought that had vanished in the night, until she realized it was on the other edge of the door, and finally flung the door open. Then she stood gulping in deep, soapy breaths and blinking her running, smarting, soap-filled eyes into a beautiful, mild morning. Bubbles sailed out past her in crowds. As her eyes cleared, Charmaine stood admiring the way big shiny bubbles caught the sunlight as they soared against the green slopes of the mountains. Most of them, she noticed, seemed to pop when they got to the end of the yard, as if there was an invisible barrier there. But some sailed on and up, as if they would go on forever. Charmaine followed them up with her eyes, past brown cliffs and green slopes. One of those green slopes must be that meadow where she had met the lubbock, but she was unable to tell which. She let her eyes go on to the pale blue sky above the peaks. It was a truly lovely day. By this time, there was a steady shimmering stream of bubbles pouring out of the kitchen. When Charmaine turned to look, the room was no longer solid foam, but there were still bubbles everywhere, and more piling out of the fireplace. Charmaine sighed and edged back indoors. until she could lean over the sink and throw the window open too. This helped enormously. Two lines of bubbles now sailed out of the house faster than before and made rainbows in the yard. The kitchen emptied rapidly. It was soon clear enough for Charmaine to see that there were now four bags of laundry leaning beside the sink in place of last night's two. "Bother that," Charmaine said. "Great Uncle William, how do I get breakfast?" It was good to hear Great Uncle William's voice among the bubbles.
"Just tap the side of the fireplace and say, 'Breakfast, please, my dear.'"
Charmaine rushed hungrily over there at once. She gave the soapy paintwork there an impatient tap. "Breakfast, please." Then found she was having to back away from a floating tray, nudging at the glasses dangling on her chest. In the centre of this tray was a sizzling plate of bacon and eggs, and crammed in around it were a coffee pot, a cup, a rack of toast, jam, butter, milk, a bowl of stewed plums, and cutlery in a starched napkin.
"Oh, lovely," she said.
And before it could all get too soapy, she seized the tray and carried it away into the living room. To her surprise, there was no sign of the afternoon tea feast that she and Peter had had last night, and the trolley was neatly back in its corner. But the room was very musty, and there were quite a few escaped bubbles coasting around in it. Charmaine went on and out through the front door. She remembered that while she was picking the pink and blue petals for the spell from the bouquet of palimpsest, she had noticed a garden table and bench outside the study window. She carried the tray round the corner of the house to look for it. She found it, in the place where the morning sun was strongest, and above it, over the pink and blue bush, the study window, even though there was no space in the house for the study to be. "Magic is interesting," she thought, as she set the tray on the table. Though the bushes around her were still dripping from the overnight rain, the bench and the table were dry. Charmaine sat down and consumed the most enjoyable breakfast she had ever had, warm in the sun and feeling lazy, luxurious, and extremely grown up. "The only thing missing is a chocolate croissant, like Dad makes," she thought, sitting back to sip her coffee. "I must tell Great Uncle William when he comes back." She had an idea that Great Uncle William must have sat here often enjoying his breakfast. The blooms on the hydrangeas around her were the finest in the garden, as if for his special pleasure. Each bush had more than one colour of flowers. The one in front of her had white flowers and pale pink and mauve. The next one over started blue on the left side and shaded over into a deep sea green on the right. Charmaine was feeling rather pleased that she had not allowed the kobold to cut these bushes down when Peter stuck his head out through the study window. This rather destroyed Charmaine's pleasure.
"Hey, where'd you get that breakfast?" Peter demanded.
Charmaine explained, and he put his head inside and went away. Charmaine stayed where she was, expecting Peter to arrive any moment, and hoping that he wouldn't. But nothing happened. After basking in the sun a while longer, Charmaine thought she would find a book to read. She carried the tray indoors and through to the kitchen first, congratulating herself on being so tidy and efficient. Peter had obviously been there because he had shut the back door, leaving only the window open, so that the room was once more filled with bubbles, floating gently toward the window and then streaming swiftly out of it. Among these bubbles loomed the great white shape of Waif. As Charmaine arrived, Waif stretched out her huge frayed tail and wagged it sharply against the mantelpiece. "A very small dog dish, piled with the amount of food suitable for a very small dog, landed among the bubbles by her enormous front paws. Waif surveyed it sadly, lowered her vast head, and slurped up the dog food in one mouthful.
"Oh, poor Waif," Charmaine said.
Waif looked up and saw her. Her huge tail began to wag, thrumming against the fireplace. A new tiny dog dish appeared with each wag. In seconds, Waif was surrounded in little dog dishes spread all over the floor.
"Don't overdo it, Waif," Charmaine said, edging among the dishes.
She put the tray down on one of the two new laundry bags and said to Waif, "I'll be in the study looking for a book if you want me," and edged her way back there. Waif ate busily and took no notice. Peter was in the study. His finished breakfast tray was on the floor beside the desk, and Peter himself was in the chair, busily leafing through one of the large leather books from the row at the back of the desk. He looked far more respectable today. Now that his hair was dry, it was in neat, tawny curls, and he was wearing what was obviously his second suit, which was of good green tweed. It was crumpled from his knapsack and had one or two round wet patches on it where bubbles had burst, but Charmaine found that she quite approved of it. As Charmaine came in, he slammed the book shut with a sigh and pushed it back in its place. Charmaine noticed that he had a piece of green string tied round his left thumb. "So that's how he managed to get in here," she thought. "I can't make head or tail of these," he said to her. "It must be in here somewhere, but I can't find it."
"What are you trying to find?" Charmaine asked.
"You said something last night about a lubbock," Peter said, "and I realized that I didn't really know what they are. I'm trying to look them up. Or do you know all about them?"
"Not really, except that they're very frightening," Charmaine confessed. "I'd like to find out about them too."
"How do we?"
Peter pointed his thumb with the green string round it at the row of books.
"These. I know these are a wizard's encyclopedia, but you have to know the sort of thing you're looking for before you can even find the right volume to look in."
Charmaine pulled her glasses up and bent to look at the books. Each one was called Res Magica, in gold, with a number under that and then a title. "Volume 3," she read. "Gyroloptica." "Volume 5, Panacticon," then down at the other end. "Volume 19, Advanced Seminal." "Volume 27, Terrestrial Oniromancy." "Volume 28, Cosmic Oniromancy."
"I see your problem," she said. "I'm going through them in order now," Peter said. "I've just done 5. It's all spells I can't make head or tail of."
He pulled out Volume 6, which was labelled simply Hex, and opened it.
"You do the next one," he said.
Charmaine shrugged and pulled forward Volume 7. It was called, not very helpfully, Potentes. She took it over to the windowsill, where there was space and light, and opened it not far from the beginning. As soon as she did, she knew it was the one. "Demon, powerful, and sometimes dangerous being," she read, "often confused with an elemental QV, and leafing on a few pages, devil, a creature of hell." After that, she was at "Elf gift, contains powers gifted by elves, QV, for the safety of a realm." And then, a wad of pages later, "Incubus, specialized devil, QV, inimical, mostly to women." She turned the pages over very slowly and carefully after that, and 20 pages on she found it.
"Lubbock, got it," she said.
"Great," Peter slammed Hex shut. "This one's nearly all diagrams. What does it say?"
He came and leaned on the windowsill beside Charmaine, and they both read the entry.
"Lubbock, a creature fortunately rare. A lubbock is a purple-hued insectile being of any size from grasshopper to larger than human. It is very dangerous, though nowadays luckily only to be encountered in wild or uninhabited areas.
A lubbock will attack any human it sees, either with its pincer-like appendages or its formidable proboscis. For 10 months of the year, it will merely tear the human to pieces for food, but in the months of July and August, it comes into its breeding season and is then especially dangerous, for in those months it will lie in wait for human travellers and, having caught one, it will lay its eggs in that human's body. The eggs hatch after 12 months, whereupon the first hatched will eat the rest, and this single new lubbock will then carve its way out of its human host. A male human will die. A female human will give birth in the normal fashion, and the offspring so born will be a lubbockan. See below. The human female then usually dies.
My goodness, I had a narrow escape, Charmaine thought, and her eyes and Peter's scudded onto the next entry.
Lubbockan, the offspring of a lubbock, QV, and a human female. These creatures normally have the appearance of a human child, except that they invariably have purple eyes. Some will have purple skin, and a few may even be born with vestigial wings. A midwife will destroy an obvious lubbockan on sight, but in many cases, lubbockans have been mistakenly reared as if they were human children. They are almost invariably evil, and since lubbockans can breed with humans, the evil nature does not disappear until several generations have passed. It is rumoured that many of the inhabitants of remote areas such as High Norland and Montalbino owe their origins to a lubbockan ancestor. It was hard to describe the effect of reading this on both Charmaine and Peter. They both wished they had not read it. Great Uncle William's sunny study suddenly felt entirely unsafe, with queer shadows in the corners. In fact, Charmaine thought, the whole house did. She and Peter both found themselves staring around uneasily, and then looking urgently out of the window for danger in the garden. Both jumped when Waif gave an outsized yawn somewhere in the corridor. Charmaine wanted to dash out there and make sure that window at the end was quite, quite shut. But first she had to look at Peter very, very carefully for any signs of purple in him. He said he came from Montalbino after all. Peter had gone very white. This showed up quite a few freckles across his nose, but they were pale orange freckles, and the meagre new hairs that grew on his chin were a sort of orange too. His eyes were a rusty sort of brown, nothing like the greenish-yellow of Charmaine's own eyes, but not purple either. She could see all this easily because Peter was staring at her quite as carefully. Her face felt cold. She could tell it had gone as white as Peter's. Finally, they both spoke at once. Charmaine said, "You're from Montalbino. Is your family purple?" Peter said, "You met a lubbock. Did it lay any eggs in you?" Charmaine said, "No." Peter said, "My mother's called the Witch of Montalbino, but she's from High Norland, really, and she is not purple. Tell me about this lubbock you met." Charmaine explained how she had climbed out of the window and arrived in the mountain pasture where the lubbock lurked inside the blue flower. But did it touch you? Peter interrupted.
"No, because I fell off the cliff before it could," Charmaine said.
"Fell off the... Then why aren't you dead?" Peter demanded. He backed away from her slightly, as if he thought she might be some kind of zombie.
"I worked a spell," Charmaine told him rather airily, because she was so proud of having worked real magic. "A flying spell."
"Really?"
said Peter, half eager, half suspicious.
"What flying spell? Where?"
"Out of a book in here," Charmaine said. "And when I fell, a I started to float and came down quite safely in the garden path. There's no need to look so disbelieving. There was a kobold called Rollo in the garden when I came down. Ask him if you don't believe me.
I will, Peter said.
What was this book? Show me.
Charmaine tossed her plait haughtily across her shoulder and went over to the desk. The book of palimpsest seemed to be trying to hide. It was certainly not where she left it. Perhaps Peter had moved it. She found it in the end, squeezed in among the row of Res Magica, pretending to be another volume of the encyclopedia.
There, she said, banging it down on top of Hex. And how dare you doubt my word? Now I'm going to find a book to read.
She marched to one of the bookshelves and began picking out likely titles. None of the books seemed to have stories in them, which Charmaine would have preferred, but some of the titles were quite interesting. What about The Thaumaturge as Artist, for instance, or Memoirs of an Exorcist? On the other hand, The Theory and Practice of Choral Invocation looked decidedly dry, but Charmaine rather fancied the one next to it called The 12-Branched Wand. Peter, meanwhile, sat himself down at the desk and leafed eagerly through the book of palimpsest. Charmaine was just discovering that The Thaumaturge as Artist was full of off-putting sayings like, "Thus a happy little magician can bring a sweet, fairy-like music to our ears," when Peter said irritably, "There's no spell for flying in here. I've looked right through."
"Perhaps I used it up," Charmaine suggested vaguely. She took a look inside the 12-branched wand and found it a very promising read.
"Spells don't work like that," Peter said. "Where did you find it, really?"
"In there, I told you," Charmaine said. "And if you can't believe a word I say, why do you keep asking me?"
She dropped her glasses off her nose, snapped the book shut, and carried a whole pile of likely volumes out into the corridor, where she slammed the study door on Peter and marched off backward and forward through the bathroom door until she reached the living room. There, in spite of the mustiness, she decided to stay. After that entry in Res Magica, outside in the sun did not seem safe any more. She thought of the lubbock looming above the hydrangeas and sat herself firmly down on the sofa instead. She was deep in the 12-branched wand, and even beginning to understand what it was about, when there was a sharp rapping at the front door. Charmaine thought, just as she usually did, "Someone else can answer that," and read on. The door opened with an impatient rattle. Aunt Sempronia's voice said,
"Of course she's all right, Berenice. She just has her nose in a book, as usual."
Charmaine tore herself out of the book and snatched off her glasses, in time to see her mother following Aunt Sempronia into the house. Aunt Sempronia, as usual, was most impressively clothed in stiff silk. Mrs. Baker was at her most respectable in grey, with shining white collar and cuffs, and wore her most respectable grey hat. "How lucky I put on clean clothes this," Charmaine was beginning to think, when it dawned on her that the rest of the house was simply not fit for either of these two ladies to see. Not only was the kitchen full of dirty human dishes and dirty dog dishes, bubbles, laundry, and a vast white dog, but Peter was sitting in the study. Mother would probably only find the kitchen, and that was bad enough. But Aunt Sempronia was, pretty certainly, a witch, and she would find the study and come across Peter. Then Mother would want to know what an unknown boy was doing here, and when Peter was explained, Mother would say that in that case, Peter could look after Great-Uncle William's house for him, and Charmaine must do the respectable thing and come home at once. Aunt Sempronia would agree, and off home Charmaine would be forced to go. And there would be an end to peace and freedom. Charmaine jumped to her feet and smiled terrifically, so broadly and welcomingly that she thought she might have sprained her face.
"Oh, hello," she said, I didn't hear the door.
You never do, said Aunt Sempronia.
Mrs. Baker peered at Charmaine full of anxiety.
Are you all right, my love? Quite all right. Why haven't you put your hair up properly?
I like it like this, Charmaine said, shuffling across so that she was between the two ladies and the kitchen door. Don't you think it suits me, Aunt Sempronia? Aunt Sempronia leaned on her parasol and looked at her judiciously.
Yes, she said, it does. It makes you look younger and plumper. Is that how you want to look?
Yes, it is, Charmaine said defiantly. Mrs. Baker sighed.
Darling, I wish you wouldn't talk in that bold way. People don't like it, you know. But I'm very glad to see you looking so well. I lay awake half the night listening to the rain and hoping that the roof on this house didn't leak.
It doesn't leak, Charmaine said.
Or fearing that you might have left a window open, added her mother.
Charmaine shuddered. No, I shut the window, she said, and immediately felt sure that Peter was at that moment opening the window onto the Lubbock's meadow.
You really have nothing to worry about, Mother, she lied. Well, to tell the truth, I was a little worried, Mrs. Baker said. Your first time away from the nest, you know. I spoke to your father about it. He said you might not be managing to feed yourself properly.
She held up the bulging embroidered bag she was carrying.
He packed you some more food in this. I'll just go and put it in the kitchen for you, shall I? She asked, and pushed past Charmaine toward the inner door.
No, help, Charmaine thought. She took hold of the embroidered bag in what she hoped was a most gentle, civilized way, rather than the grab for it that she would have liked to make, and said,
You needn't bother, Mother. I'll take it in a moment, and fetch the other one for you.
Oh, why, it's no trouble, my love. Her mother protested, hanging on to the bag.
Because I've got a surprise for you first, Charmaine said hurriedly. You go and sit down.
That sofa's very comfortable, Mother, and it has its back to this door.
Do take a seat, Aunt Sempronia.
But it won't take me a moment, Mrs. Baker said, if I leave it on the kitchen table where you can find it.
Charmaine waved her free hand. Her other hand was hanging on to the bag for dear life.
Great Uncle William, she cried out. Morning coffee, please.
To her enormous relief, Great Uncle William's kind voice replied,
Tap the trolley in the corner, my dear, and say, Morning coffee.
Mrs. Baker gasped with amazement and looked round to see where the voice was coming from. Aunt Sempronia looked interested, looked quizzical, and went over to give the trolley a smart rap with her parasol.
Morning coffee, she said.
Instantly the room filled with a warm smell of coffee. A tall silver coffee pot stood on the trolley, steaming, together with tiny gilded cups, a gilded cream jug, a silver sugar boat, and a plate of little sugary cakes. Mrs. Baker was so astonished that she let go of the embroidered bag. Charmaine put it quickly behind the nearest armchair.
Very elegant magic, Aunt Sempronia said. Berenice, come and sit down here and let Charmaine wheel the trolley over beside the sofa.
Mrs. Baker obeyed, looking dazed, and to Charmaine's acute relief, the visit started to turn into an elegant, respectable coffee morning. Aunt Sempronia poured coffee while Charmaine handed round the sugary cakes. Charmaine was standing facing the kitchen door, holding the plate out to Aunt Sempronia, when the door swung open and Waif's huge face appeared round the edge of it, obviously fetched by the smell of little sugary cakes.
"Go away, Waif," Charmaine said. "Shoo! I mean it. You can't come in here unless you're respectable. Go!"
Waif stared wistfully, sighed hugely, and backed away.
By the time Mrs. Baker and Aunt Sempronia, each carefully holding a brimming little coffee cup, had managed to turn round to see who Charmaine was talking to, Waif was gone and the door was shut again.
"What was that?" Mrs. Baker asked.
"Nothing," Charmaine said soothingly. "Only great-uncle William's guard-dog, you know. She's terribly greedy."
"You have a dog here?"
Mrs. Baker interrupted in the greatest alarm. "I'm not sure I like that, Charmaine. Dogs are so dirty, and you could get bitten. I hope you keep it chained up."
No, she's terribly clean and obedient,"
Charmaine said, wondering if this was true. It's just that she overeats. Great-uncle William tries to keep her on a diet, so of course she was after one of these cakes. The kitchen door opened again. This time it was Peter's face that came round the edge of it, with a look on it that suggested that Peter had something urgent to say. The look turned to horror as he took in Aunt Sempronia's finery and Mrs. Baker's respectability.
"Here she is again," Charmaine said rather desperately. "Waif, go away."
Peter took the hint and vanished, just before Aunt Sempronia could turn round again and see him. Mrs. Baker looked more alarmed than ever.
"You worry too much, Berenice," Aunt Sempronia said. "I admit that dogs are smelly and dirty and noisy, but there's nothing to beat a good guard dog for keeping a house safe. You should be glad that Charmaine has one."
"I suppose so," Mrs. Baker agreed, sounding wholly unconvinced.
But didn't you tell me this house is protected by your great-uncle's, wizardly arts?"
Yes, it is," Charmaine said eagerly. "The place is doubly safe."
"Of course it is," said Aunt Sempronia. "I believe that nothing can get in here that hasn't been invited over the threshold."
As if to prove Aunt Sempronia completely wrong there, a kobold suddenly appeared on the floor beside the trolley.
"Now look here," he said, small and blue and aggressive.
Mrs. Baker gave a shriek and clutched her coffee cup to her bosom. Aunt Sempronia drew her skirts back from him in a stately way. The kobold stared at them, clearly puzzled, and then looked at Charmaine. He was not the garden kobold. His nose was bigger, his blue clothing was of finer cloth, and he looked as if he was used to giving orders.
"Are you an important kobold?" Charmaine asked him.
"Well," the kobold said, rather taken aback, "you could say that. I'm chieftain in these parts, name of Timmins. I'm leading this deputation, and we're all pretty annoyed. And now we're told that the wizard isn't here or won't see us or—"
Charmaine could see he was working himself into a rage. She said quickly, "That's true. He's not here. He's ill. The elves have taken him away to cure him, and I'm looking after his house while he's away." The kobold hunched his eyes over his great blue nose and glowered at her.
"Are you telling the truth?"
"I seem to have spent all day being told I'm lying," Charmaine thought angrily.
"It is the exact truth," Aunt Sempronia said. "William Norland is not here at present. So will you be so kind as to take yourself off, my good kobold? You are frightening poor Mrs. Baker."
The kobold glowered at her and then at Mrs. Baker.
"Then," he said to Charmaine, "I don't see any chance of this dispute being settled, ever."
And he was gone as suddenly as he'd come.
"Oh, my goodness," Mrs. Baker gasped, holding her chest. "So little, so blue. How did it get in?"
"Don't let it run up your skirt, Charmaine."
"It was only a kobold," Aunt Sempronia said. "Pull yourself together, Berenice. Kobolds, as a rule, do not get on with humans, so I have no idea what it was doing here. But I suppose Great-Uncle William must have had some sort of dealings with the creatures. There's no accounting for wizards."
"And I've spilled coffee," Mrs. Baker wailed, mopping at her skirt.
Charmaine took the little cup and soothingly filled it with coffee again. "Have another cake, Mother," she said, holding the plate out. "Great Uncle William has a kobold to do the gardening, and that one was angry too when I met him."
"What was the gardener doing in the living room?" Mrs. Baker demanded.
As often happened, Charmaine began to despair of getting her mother to understand.
"She's not stupid. She just never lets her mind out," she thought.
"That was a different kobold," she began. The kitchen door opened, and Waif trotted in. She was the right size again. That meant that she was, if anything, smaller than the kobold, and very pleased with herself for shrinking. She trotted jauntily across to Charmaine and raised her nose wistfully toward the cake plate.
"Honestly, Waif," Charmaine said, "when I think how much you ate for breakfast..."
"Is that the guard dog?" Mrs. Baker quavered.
"If it is," Aunt Sempronia opined, "it would come off second best against a mouse. How much did you say it ate for breakfast?"
"About 50 dog dishes full," Charmaine said without thinking.
50? Said her mother.
"I was exaggerating," Charmaine said. Waif, seeing them all looking at her, sat up into begging position with her paws under her chin. She contrived to look enchanting. It was the way she managed to make one ragged ear flop that did it, Charmaine decided.
"Oh, what a sweet little doggie," Mrs. Baker cried out. "Is oo hungry then?"
She gave Waif the rest of the cake she was eating. Waif took it politely, ate it in one gulp, and continued to beg. Mrs. Baker gave her a whole cake from the plate. This caused Waif to beg more soulfully than ever.
"I'm disgusted," Charmaine told Waif.
Aunt Sempronia graciously handed a cake over to Waif too.
"I must say," she said to Charmaine, "with this great hound to guard you, no one need fear for your safety, although you might go rather hungry yourself."
"She's good at barking," Charmaine said.
"And there's no need to be sarcastic, Aunt Sempronia. I know she isn't a guard dog." But Charmaine had no sooner thought this than she realized that Waif was guarding her. She had taken Mother's attention completely away from kobolds or the kitchen or any dangers to Charmaine herself, and she had contrived to reduce herself to the right size to do it. Charmaine found herself so grateful that she gave Waif a cake as well. Waif thanked her very charmingly by nosing her hand and then turned her expectant attention to Mrs. Baker again.
"Oh, she's so sweet," Mrs. Baker sighed and rewarded Waif with a fifth cake.
"She'll burst," Charmaine thought. Nevertheless, thanks to Waif, the rest of the visit went off most peacefully, until right at the end, when the ladies got up to go, Mrs. Baker said, "Oh, I nearly forgot," and felt in her pocket. "This letter came for you, darling." She held out to Charmaine a long, stiff envelope with a red wax seal on the back of it. It was addressed to Mistress Charmaine Baker in elegant, quavery writing. Charmaine stared at the letter and found her heart was banging away in her ears and her chest like a blacksmith at an anvil. Her eyes went fuzzy. Her hand shook as she took the letter. The king had replied to her. He had actually answered. She knew it was the king. The address was in the same quavery writing that she had found on the letter in Great Uncle William's study.
"Oh, thanks," she said, trying to sound casual.
"Open it, dear," her mother said. "It looks very grand. What do you think it is?"
"Oh, it's nothing," Charmaine said. "It's only my leaver's certificate."
"This was a mistake," her mother exclaimed.
"What? But your father is expecting you to stay on at school and learn a little culture, darling."
"Yes, I know. But they always give everyone a certificate at the end of the 10th year, Charmaine invented, in case some of us do want to leave, you know. My whole class will have got one too. Don't worry. In spite of this explanation, which Charmaine considered quite brilliant, Mrs. Baker did worry. She might have made a very great fuss had not Waif suddenly sprung up onto her hind legs and walked at Mrs. Baker with her front paws most appealingly tucked under her chin again. "Oh, you sweetheart!" Mrs. Baker exclaimed. "Charmaine, if your great-uncle lets you bring this darling little dog home with you when he's better, I shan't mind a bit. I really shan't." Charmaine was able to stuff the king's letter into a waistband and kiss her mother and then Aunt Sempronia goodbye without either of them mentioning it again. She waved them happily off down the path between the hydrangeas and shut the front door behind them with a gasp of relief. "Thank you, Waif," she said. "You clever dog." She leaned against the front door and started to open the king's letter. "Though I know in advance he's bound to say no," she told herself, shivering with excitement. "I would say no if it was me." Before she had the envelope more than half open, the other door was flung open by Peter. "Have they gone?" he said. "At last. I need your help. I'm being mobbed by angry kobolds in here."